My libertarianism would be not deontic libertarianism, like mm-hmm. You know, the philosophical libertarianism,
right.
that's, you know, freedom comes as a first good,
right.
So much as I want errors to be multiplied.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Nassim Nicholas Taleb. Taleb's latest book is Anti-Fragility, Things That Gain with Disorder, which looks at how to create institutions that can survive in the face of chaos and adversity. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Let's talk about anti-fragility. What is anti-fragility as you discuss it in the book, and you know, why is it so important?
Okay. First, I need to tell you what fragility is.
Okay.
Once you map fragility as what does not like volatility, then you can realize that that the opposite would be something that likes volatility and likes variation, likes turmoil, likes stress, up to a point. And the opposite would be robust. Robust is like a rock, doesn't care. Diamond is robust, perfectly robust. What is antifragile gains from disorder and effectively may even need disorder for fuel. So here you have three categories for objects. The fragile doesn't like volatility. The robust doesn't care. The resilient, the adaptable, really doesn't improve from stress.
And you talk about it in terms of materials, that a robust thing. You mentioned a rock or a diamond. It's just there. It doesn't gain, but it can shatter from being
up to a point. You know, you're always robust or fragile, anti-fragile up to a point.
Right. But then anti-fragility and fragility applies more to kind of systems or human living organisms.
Exactly. What people fail to understand, and this is where libertarians tend to pick it up rather quickly, is that even when you read Adam Smith, you have this illusion that economy functions like a machine. Mm-hmm. It's not like a washing machine. A washing machine needs maintenance. It's more like a cat than a washing machine.
So
like
this,
your human body needs some stressors, and everything organic and complex communicates with the environment via stressors.
Mm-hmm. So give a, you know, when you say the economy is not like a washing machine, it's more like a cat. I mean, that's basically it's an organic whole, or an organic isn't the right word, but it's a complex system.
It's organic-like, I call it organic-like complex system, yes.
Okay. And then is it true, though, that in a complex system like that, then is every element of it, is it kind of a fractal system where then each actor, each atom has to be...
It's exactly fractal in the sense that you have layers. Mm-hmm. Like, just like the restaurant business, okay, is composed of restaurants, you see. And for the restaurant business to be robust, at least robust, or perhaps anti-fragile, you need every single restaurant to be fragile,
right?
You see, so it's the opposite of Nietzsche. What doesn't kill me makes me stronger. I make claims what kills me makes others stronger.
That's right. Because
they learn from your mistakes.
That's right.
And you have evolutionary forces where the individual sacrifice for the collective, and it works within your biological system, even at the cellular level. You have you're composed of cells. If you harm some cells, you see, your overall health will improve.
Now this, talk a little bit more about that, because most people would say, okay, when you have a system and if there's a contagion in it, if there's a cancer in it, if there's some kind of stressor that starts taking over, it's going to spread to the whole system.
Okay,
and isn't this what we hear in the banking, in the financial crisis, that, oh, there's a contagion and it spreads out? You're arguing that actually a robust or an anti-fragile system is capable of seeing this part of the system being cancered and learning from it.
Exactly. Cite the great Yogi Berra.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
A good anti-fragile system is a system in which all mistakes are good mistakes.
Right.
You see. And a bad system is one in which, as again, to paraphrase Yogi Berra, you tend to make the wrong mistakes.
Right.
So let's compare the banking system to transportation. Mm-hmm. All right. Every plane crash makes the next plane crash less likely and our transportation safer. Now with the banking system, it's because of, you may blame it on government, I do blame it on government, but it could be something else.
Mm-hmm. Say you do blame it on government?
I do sort of blame it on large government, means large banks too big to fail.
But the
failure of a bank leads to an increased probability of a failure of the entire system. And that's a bad system.
How, just with the banking system, what's the best way to stop that so that you're not allowing the problem to replicate throughout the system?
Okay, the way I present things is overall. I say, what fragilizes an overall system? What does fragilize the order system? The three things. Number one, centralization. Decentralization spreads mistakes, makes smaller mistakes, like Switzerland, perfectly decentralized, and smack in the middle of Europe. So decentralization, which is where we converge with libertarians. Right. A second one is low debt, because we've discovered since the Babylonians that debt has systemic consequences, whereas equity, doesn't have the same.
Well, wait, now talk about this, because I happen to agree with you that large debt, and we're at what 100% of the I'm just saying, just today or yesterday, Paul Krugman, one of your great friends and nemeses, right?
Yeah.
He was writing about these trillion-dollar deficits. They don't matter. Debt, large amounts of debt. So why does debt make things more fragile?
Let me talk from risk-based system. Sure. All these economists, they're not, say, let's put it this way, risk is not their thing, all right? So so the second idea is debt, and the third one, I would say, is skin in the game. So let's talk about debt. Debt leads to fragility, because let's say that you have two brothers. One of them borrowed. And they both have provisions about the future, forecasts, predictions about the future. His one brother borrows, the other issues equity. The one who borrows will go bust if he makes a mistake. The one who has issued equity will fluctuate, but will be able to survive a forecast error.
But is it also true that the brother with equity can never really have that big payday?
For him, but overall for the system, see, the thing is well distributed. There's an accounting equality. So what you have is debt, traditionally, debt has blown up systems and has been very good for governments to wage war. That's typically. But I'm not against credit. I'm against leverage. Credit, letter of credit is what made commerce possible. So what we have
A little bit about that. So then what's the difference between credit, where you give me a loan and I allow and I say I'm going to pay you back, and that gives me the ability to get something in the short run that will help me produce more in the long run. That's okay.
Letters of credit most of banking started mostly I trust you. You're going to go to Aleppo, Syria, and I'm in Florence, and you're going to send me some silk. And you trust me, and then I give you some money, and then silk, and then my correspondent in Aleppo would pay you the minute I get my silk, that kind of transaction. So that's called letter of credit, where you have like debt conditional on some commercial transaction being completed. Okay, and it allows people to finance some inventory, provided the buyer is a committed buyer. That kind of facilitation of commerce is how it all started, the letter of credit, and it developed very well. Before that, we had debt in society, and it led to blow-ups in Babylon, and then they had to have debt jubilees, and then, of course, the Hebrews also had debt jubilees, and of course, say, neither borrowers nor lenders shall be in the Septuagint. You see that. And then you had the Romans didn't like that. The Greeks sort of didn't like that, except for a few intellectuals for some reason, like Mr. Krugman, liked that.
And by the way, that's really diminishing the currency of the term intellectual. But
okay. But and then of course later on, debt came back to Europe with the Reformation, and it was mostly to finance wars. The Industrial Revolution was not financed by debt. California. You told me that you read my book on a Kindle or something like that. This was not financed by debt. It was financed by equity.
Right.
So debt is not necessary. I mean, you can use it for emergencies, and of course we have a lot of societies, Catholic societies. Aquinas was against debt, and his statements were stronger than the Islamic fatwa against debt.
Right.
So just to tell you that we have learned through history that these things, debt as leverage, form of leverage, can blow things up. So this is where debt fragilizes. Now, what we have had, of course, in this economy is growth of debt, mostly financed indirectly by governments, because you blow up, we're going to be behind you. And that was, that's what we're dealing with.
So this is the problem with too big to fail, which went from being a worry to being inscribed in official policy.
Exactly. It became sort of like the mode. And then, but you cannot separate the three.
Right.
large government, you cannot separate it. It's inseparable. The third point is skin in the game.
Right.
When you're a banker, right, and you have the upside, no downside, what are you going to do? Create the maximum number of loans that don't blow up often,
right,
and collect your bonuses. Mm-hmm. It's like selling out of the money option. And then, of course, you blow up. Now, how do I link this to fragility? It's very simple. Fragility is short volatility, you see, and selling an out of the money option is short a certain class of volatility. And what you have is a banker has the option, he has the upside, and you have his, if you pay taxes every April 15, you're paying for his downside. Okay, that's it, all right? They may make money, but it still covers his downside. So this is, this to me is not capitalism, it's misunderstanding of basic rules. And skin in the game, you know, started with Hammurabi. It led later on to eye for eye and led to the golden rules, right?
Well, now talk about how skin in the game plays out then in the current financial crisis. Okay.
I mean, I work on Wall Street, I work everywhere. You have a lot of forms of asymmetries that are not visible to the public. Corporation, right? You start, you own a corporation, and then you go public now, and then you sell it to some manager. Now your professional manager, his aim is to look good so he can collect the bonus. He doesn't really care about the intrinsic health of the corporation. In banking, of course, bankers, we bail them out. In banking, I wrote on the Black Swan. I got so many letters. Asked me to prove it because people didn't believe it, and also bankers, of course, didn't like my book. By 1983, for the last quarter of 1982, banks lost more money in money center banks that quarter than they made in the history of banking, of money center banking. And of course, we bailed them out. So we started the mode under Reagan.
Right.
And of course, later on, Greenspan made economic policy to accommodate.
You refer to Greenspan as the Fragilista doctor.
Fragilista, exactly.
Yeah, okay.
But it's not just Greenspan that was a Fragilista. It was a system that bailed out banks, nationalized Continental Illinois, and then suddenly allowed this asymmetries to prevail.
Where is that coming from, though? Is that, and this is where you talk about it's. I mean, big government is necessary for that, but then the pressure is coming from the banking industry themselves?
Well, the whole combination, big government, big central government was a big, bailing out authority, coupled with a huge number of regulators who don't have a clue and who eventually are indirectly on a take, because, in Africa, you see people have outright corruption, where I give you diamonds or something. Whereas in Washington, you have this implicit, corruption. I call it the Tony Blair problem. The Tony Blair problem is you do a good job, and then you're going to go be able to work for $5 million a year at Goldman Sachs. So whatever you're going to do as a regulator is going to be there to either facilitate your job at Goldman Sachs or make regulations complex enough to make yourself necessary later on. And we have evidence of that.
You know, going back to that idea of a kind of fractal system, Adam Smith said that, while each person is pursuing their own, personal desires or their personal benefits, the whole system gets more robust. But you're saying actually that there are these actors in our system that are not the manager of a bank.
What makes
how did that happen? Okay. And is that a necessary or is it an inevitable outgrowth of larger and larger economic systems?
Exactly. No, it's not necessary for economic system. If you let things fail, if you don't let things fail, you're going to have concentration of mistakes.
Right.
You see, that plus asymmetry doesn't work very well. Plus risk hiding, where you have regular. I mean, I was. Spent 20 years fighting something called value at risk that is was mandated by regulators and allows people to hide risk in the tail. To me, when you have skin in the game, it solves so many problems. Okay. People are harmed first by their own mistakes.
So with the banking system, how do we make sure that the banks, and this is a common thing that, banks or mortgage underwriters were able to sell off whatever,
There you go.
They had nothing to lose by making bad deals. So how do you keep their skin in the game, especially when things are going to be traded on secondary and tertiary?
Yeah, I mean, you don't have to go as far as that. Just have at the level of a bank itself, right? So we don't bail out banks. Here we're bailing out individuals through these securitized mortgages. But just take the level of a bank. Bob Rubin made $120 million helping to stuff Citibank with risks.
Right.
And his boss made even more. And then they blew up, we're paying for it. Mm-hmm. And bankers even spat in our face by paying themselves 2010, mm-hmm. higher level of bonuses than ever in history, all right? But so how do we solve it? Very simple, I have rules. I don't believe in nationalization, mm-hmm. but I believe as a taxpayer, I would have a list of banks, all right? Mm-hmm. Decentralization solve the problem, but if you don't have decentralization, have a list of institutions in this country, all right? Yeah. If they fail, would it be a national emergency to save them? Mm-hmm. Yes, no. Mm-hmm. If the answer is yes, you call them up, you tell them effectively, as of tomorrow morning, mm-hmm. 9 a.m., you belong to the taxpayer.
Right.
The taxpayer should be able to set your bonuses. Mm-hmm. Okay? You see? That way you don't mm-hmm. have warped incentive.
Who is making that list?
It would be the taxpayer, whoever represents it. Government, whatever, however you want to call it. The government for that, but saying we cannot bail out a company, mm-hmm. all right? De facto, they're civil servants, mm-hmm. you see? So we have to decide on their bonuses. Right. So what would it do? It would force corporation mm-hmm. to be small enough that they wouldn't be on that list.
Right.
That's one form.
Right.
Another one to solve associated problems would be what I call the Tony Blair rule. Mm-hmm. The Tony Blair rule, you cannot go work for the government mm-hmm. and ever later on have an income, higher income than what you earn, indexed for inflation, without paying it to the taxpayer. Why? Because I don't want the regulator to go make mm-hmm. to make something, all right, to complexify his stuff to go make $5 million for Goldman Sachs. Go work for Goldman Sachs now.
Are these thought experiments, or do you actually think that these are rules that could be implemented and enforced?
These are heuristics. I came up with simple heuristics, right. And you want to come up with heuristics that you know are not perfect, mm-hmm. but very applicable and solve complex problems mm-hmm. without having side effects.
Right.
Okay. And to me, it's very important, and to have these heuristics, and that would clean up Washington. Mm-hmm. If you have such a stringent rule, so you want to work for Goldman Sachs, go work tomorrow for mm-hmm. Goldman Sachs. Don't go work, after a career. And so it should be that working for Washington should not be an investment strategy.
Right.
So that would automatically you control the government. Mm-hmm. On our
now you talk about decentralization, and one of the things that is kind of fascinating about the global economy over the past 50 years. I mean, you could argue over the past 1,000 years is that in many ways it's becoming more and more decentralized. Certain types of knowledge are more decentralized than ever before. Economies in many ways compete in a way that they didn't before because countries can no longer force investors to keep their money in a particular currency, in a particular geographic location. So are we, even as we're facing a global crisis, are we in fact seeing,
this is leading to more centralization.
Okay, talk a little bit about that then.
We used to have, there's something in nature
called globalization is generally a good thing, right?
It is if you know how to handle it, right? If you know how to handle it, if you let firms fail, mm-hmm. okay? There's something called the island effect. And the island effect in nature is as follows. An island will have much higher number of species per square meter than a continent, mm-hmm. and actually it's proportional to the square of mm-hmm. the area. Right. Yeah, so it is shockingly robust, mm-hmm. across them. So we've lost the island effect. Now you have Google dominating the whole planet, stuff mm-hmm. like that. It's not a problem. The thing is, if we stop letting these firms fail mm-hmm. when they become ill, and they can get large enough to dominate mm-hmm. government. So the problem is, if you let them fail. Now, computer firms, I'm not worried about.
Mm-hmm. Why aren't you worried about computer firms?
Because it's a competitive environment.
Right. Okay.
Google is a
product
of competitive environment.
I mean, we can see the end of Google on the horizon.
We can see the end of Google.
We know Microsoft
difference.
Is
no
different.
Difference. Yeah. No difference. Yeah. No difference. Right. For you and I, if Google fails tomorrow, or there'll be something else. Mm-hmm. Don't worry. Yeah. It's not like it would be dramatic, mm-hmm. and the government won't save them.
Right.
Okay. So, and I don't think they'll fail because for that reason, given that they know the government won't save them. But if you have so you can have some centralization concentration. That's not the problem. Mm-hmm. The problem is we have had in almost all Western countries, nominally, they say, decentralization, decentralizing, but effectively they've had more and more power to the government, central government, mm-hmm. like the United States.
Okay.
So you want decisions to be spread out. Mm-hmm. Now, government debt is a result of centralization and typically the cause of more centralization. Mm-hmm. It's a very bad circle.
Right.
You see, government debt now, most of the debt now is transferred to the government mm-hmm. with a small number of people calling the shots. Mm-hmm. And some fellow, you know, with a beard who sort of looks like me, but I hope not too much, is printing like there was no tomorrow. He has no clue. All right.
Why is that? Why is that not? Isn't that exactly what we need? Though we need a monetary stimulus.
Because we need. I don't understand this. No, yeah. I understand. Rather understand that the mistakes coming from that can be monstrous. Mm-hmm. The point is that you need to look at risks of things. You see, some planes may go faster.
Right.
But you wouldn't want to be on them because they're going to crash.
Right.
You see, we've got to look at things with a risk adjustment standpoint or the risk vision. There's another thing about skin in the game. Bureaucrats don't have skin in the game. They have a spreadsheet looking at them. Mm-hmm. At local government, people are much more responsible for deficits. But the real cause isn't the smallest beautiful argument. Mm-hmm. The real cause is what I explained here. Everything comes back to volatility. When you're large, you get to be short volatility. Mm-hmm. Why? A £100 million project in the UK tend to cost 30% more in overruns and problems than a £5 million project. So you have these errors scale faster and faster, and that is bad for the system.
How do we get to a point, because clearly, at least in terms of political economy and the intersection of big government and big business, there's no way in hell we're going to let companies fail anymore, it seems. What are the steps that can be taken to not necessarily scale things back, but just to finally say, okay, you know what? Yeah, we're letting you go. Because during the banking crisis here, people were like, look, Hank Paulson, who is certainly one of your bete noirs, he said, look, it's Friday afternoon. If we don't do something this weekend, on Monday, money won't come out of the ATM machines. How do you argue back against
You're a libertarian, are you?
Yes, I certainly
am. You are a libertarian. What would you rather have, nationalization of the banks or moral hazard in the system?
I would rather have moral hazard. Minimize moral hazard.
Okay, yeah. The way you minimize moral hazard, you nationalize immediately and then work with it.
Okay.
So what we've done is...
Sweden did at
Hank
one
Paulson
point.
Led... Okay, yeah. The one thing people don't know, we're talking about deficits all the time, all right?
Right.
$500 billion every year. We looked at the firms, foreign and U.S., that were helped by the Fed during the crisis of 2008.
Right.
We looked at the compensation to their employees, $500 billion. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's not government money, what is government money? And that's part of our deficit, you see? That potentially, we're going to have to pay back. Banking is a very inefficient business.
Right.
So I think that we should have nationalized. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't have had the problems we've had later, and then you'd be forced to reorganize.
Now, do you think it worked then in the context of GM, where the president was dictating personnel decisions?
Nationalization is not something to save the company and bring it back to health. Mm-hmm. Nationalization is because the system doesn't work.
Right.
Okay. You nationalize, and then you. Mm-hmm. Start from, you have, the government has control, and we're no longer hijacked by the bankers. Mm-hmm. What has happened is the bankers took over the government. And with the Geithner.
And so this is Geithner, Paulson, Rubin.
Rubin, if you see the difference between Rubin and Paulson, you need a microscope in the end, all right? So it's that mafia of Wall Streeters who took over the government. I mean, look at what happened in 2010. How can we, as taxpayers, tolerate their paying themselves the largest bonus pool ever in 2010?
Well, to talk a little bit more about the fragility and anti-fragility argument, in an excerpt from Anti-Fragility, or a part of it, you talked about how you used to go to, after you realized you didn't have to wear a jacket and tie everywhere, you went to conferences of kind of futurists and people in the high-tech industry, as well as kind of hip investment bankers. And at first you thought these people were liberated, but then you said that there was a problem with them, that they were kind of autistic, and that they had an engineering mind.
Well, there's something, I mean, I'm effectively close to things to an engineer, but there's something called neomania. Neomania is when you want to change things, when you think the future is in more technological items. Mm-hmm. And if you look at evidence, exact opposite. I mean, we're in a room here, we're sitting on chairs, Egyptian, but mostly reserved.
And these cameras go back to the ancient Babylonians, but...
But what my point is that when you forecast the future, you tend to add complex items right. to it, and effectively is what you could do is remove the complex items that we are in the modern today, like the cameras I would remove, but the chair I would keep.
That's right.
But something else
and
replace
the cameras
the camera.
Are models of something that started 100 years ago.
Exactly, and they will be replaced by something else. So there's something I call Lindy law and it maps to fragility. The longer something has been in print, the longer it will be in print.
Right.
The longer the technology is, anything non-perishable.
So things are supplemental rather than revolutionary. I mean, we're not constantly ripping things out.
No, actually, it's even beyond that. It's like we're more into improvement of things that exist already than anything else. Okay.
Well, this leads to one of the things that I thought was most interesting about anti-fragility was your emphasis. I mean, you're teaching at a, you know, you teach risk management, you're good at math, or let me put it this way, you get into a lot of arguments about math, yet your writing style and your field of reference is very literary, is very historical.
Roman. Literary, but Roman.
Okay, and at one point you wrote that, you know, the one of the things that bothers you about economics and about a lot of social sciences is there's an absence of literary culture and that leads to a future blindness. Talk a little bit about that, because the way we're taught in the U.S., is you know kind of literature, the humanities are kind of bullshit, or it's like frosting you put on top of something else.
No, okay, I have a my view is a little different. Is I like to teach the classics, not to teach what Scott Fitzgerald ate for breakfast on a given day. You see, that to me is not literary. Not one.
Right.
This is why I don't hang around literary circles.
Right. You are famously anti-artsy farts.
Exactly. Okay. So you read about it. It's, I like the distilled wisdom of the ancients. There's a remarkable amount of wisdom that, in fact, is something anti-fragile to it, or at least robust. If you map fragility into has more downside than upside from random events, which is exactly what is concave in mathematical form or shape, is hates volatility. Once you map fragility that way, an existing item, anti-fragile means has more upside than downside. The first person to really understand the point in history was Seneca. Seneca wasn't Greek,
Seneca,
he was Roman.
The great
he was
Stoic,
wealthiest
philosopher,
man, Stoic
playwright,
philosopher.
Tutor to Nero.
Right. But he was the wealthiest man in the world in his day, right. supposedly, happened to be for a while. It was random at the time. But his idea was how to get more upside than downside in life. And he realized when you have wealth that you have more downside than upside from it. You get used to it, you have habituated, and then
this is one of the reasons why I stay poor. Because I'm always on the upside.
Well, that's his idea. He forced himself to become poor. Okay, he had 500 desks to write on, but he faked like he was a shipwreck once a week, something like that. So he understood that notion of anti-fragility, and it's very strange. Scholars
How did it end for Seneca?
Well, he committed suicide, but it was dignity. The whole idea is the entire idea for a Stoic is that you can't control randomness; you can control how you behave.
Right.
And he behaved the way he died, the way he wanted to die, which is with honor.
Talk about, because one of the things that is, I suspect is one of the reasons why you are as kind of popular and as, which isn't quite the right word, but as dashing a figure as you are, is that in the United States, certainly, it's rare for an intellectual, particularly one who's good at math, to also have any sense of, you know, that the Romans existed as something, you know, something we could still learn from. You decided at an early age you were interested in becoming a philosopher. Talk about that and then how that linked into the work that you're doing now.
Okay, well, I mean, I wanted to be a philosopher from the beginning, but then I decided, then there was civil war in Lebanon, I left, came back from France, and I went back and I realized I had too many books to read. And I loved reading, but I hated to be given books to read. Because if you're bored with it, you lose the option. I like optionality.
Well, and you think the autodidact is
The optionality of switching to finding your own path rather than being in a straitjacket, of university stuff like that. So then I realized that I had better study something more technical, all right. And then of course I continued two lives, one technical, all right, and one non-technical. And the technical led to option trading. All right, and the option trading led to more doctorate related to probability theory applied to options, and some problems, in off model, in some obscure stuff. So my background was technical by day, literary at night. You see, the classics aren't really Roman, but I think like a Roman.
Right.
The Arabs and the Greeks think in the same way. They love theory. They respect theory. They respect ideas. Mm-hmm. They respect same things, top down.
Right.
Whereas, although the Arabs were, you know, into systems that were bottom up, but they, thought-wise, they respect top down. And the Romans were immensely heuristic.
Right. And they, I mean, it's experience versus
exactly.
empiricism versus abstraction.
It is a form of tinkering and trial and error. And then the Romans understood optionality. They understood that their constitution of the republic was made through adversity. Mm-hmm. You see, bouncing back every time, getting better, and rather than Lycurgus from top down thinking of how things should be. And in a way, they figured out what it took me a long time, you know, to be able to put down on paper: optionality, the option of changing. Not being locked into a plan. Right. They understood it.
But at the same time, also using the past as a guide or as a framework.
Exactly. Same as I was talking, Lindy effect, is technologies. Right. What has survived has to have survived for a reason.
Right.
So it could be hidden reason. You don't understand. You don't try to rationalize.
Right.
So
but you're also, I mean, but you're not slavishly devoted to replicating the past or preserving the past.
No, the idea, the idea is as follows. Whatever change you're going to do needs to be incremental minimize adverse consequences of it. And you don't believe your ideas. You only believe what you see.
That's so this is really, I mean, you're very interested in the limits of knowledge rather than the perceived power of an all-encompassing universal genius.
It's exactly the opposite of someone said, what are you doing? I say, take the theory of everything. I'm doing the exact opposite. Mm-hmm. How to make decision if you don't understand everything.
Right.
So that's the idea. The
but decision, yet you do have a single kind of line of thought that runs through everything.
My line of thread is probability. Probabilities have a superb thing going for them. They add up to one. Right? So and so there are mathematical things that come from that. The fact that probabilities add up to one, that you never have the whole story, you see, so, and you never see 100% of things and stuff like that. So there is a thread. But the way I framed it here is again, it's a probabilistic thing. It's hard to explain, you know, without graphs. Is that whatever has more downside than upside from random events has some attributes, and these attributes are shared by everything that has these attributes. Like, for example, if I take a medicine and I don't understand how it works, we don't have a lot of history, I face more downside than upside. You see, or I should act as if I face more downside than upside, because benefits are seen and small. And when you go against Mother Nature, the benefits can only be small.
Right.
You see, against the history of nature if you're not very ill. So all these considerations come from the same thing. Are you long an option or short an option? And in life, you make decisions where you have maximum option, right? So it's not like a theory of everything. It's a decision-making rules that are distilled that are, to me, not as original as they appear.
Right.
They're not particularly original. If we are sitting now, 2,000 years ago, at Seneca's table, and he had a good table, right? He had a good table, and the next day he would force you to become poor again, but you can enjoy dinner. And we were talking. Nobody, you know, people would say, what are these guys talking about?
Right.
All right? It's so unoriginal. Tell us something we don't know.
Right. Right?
So that would have been, you know, so that's sort of like my background. Yes.
How does that fit in with, I mean, you have shown another reason why I think you have, really captured a public imagination is because you speak freely and openly and hostily towards your intellectual adversaries. And
I have a commitment. If I see fraud, don't shout fraud. I am a fraud.
Okay.
And
so,
it should apply to everyone.
Well, let me run through a couple of your greatest hits, because they're really good. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman, you called so vile and harmful that when you accidentally made eye contact with him, you became nauseated. Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winning economist, you talk about Stiglitz syndrome, which is what happens when public intellectuals have absolutely no responsibility for stupid and bad predictions. Nobel laureate Paul Samuelson is an intellectual fraud. Paul Krugman, I don't think you, in your entire corpus, you have anything good to say about them.
No, I mean, Samuelson and Krugman is a little different, because I didn't say, or probably I didn't remember, in that, but I say that they have no consciousness of risk. So they propose a model we should follow, they don't have no idea of risk. Okay. And I think risk should come first, because you're endangering the public by giving reduced models. But the idea that runs through the whole thing is, let me be technical for 2 minutes so I can relax.
Sure.
Something called Jensen's inequality, which is like when you have a convex payoff, you benefit from randomness, and when you have concave payoff, any error of your model is likely to hurt you.
Right.
Okay, and typically they have concave payoffs. Mm-hmm. Like the policies by Krugman, all these can be voiced as concave payoffs.
Right.
Nothing wrong except they don't know it.
Right.
You see? This is what I mean, is missing nonlinearity of items. It's a little technical. So in the end, I have a section showing, you know, how, you know, we can talk about mistakes made in economics by having concave payoffs.
What is your goal as a public figure?
I mean, I don't want to be a public figure. Okay. I mean, I spent 5 years after Black Swan. Mm-hmm. Well, the first 6 months, 9 months, 1 year, I, you know, walked around thinking it was nice to go to Davos. And then I didn't like it, came back home.
Why didn't you like it?
Too many empty suits, and also, what's my profession? It's to write books.
Okay.
Well, I only write articles. Let me tell you, I only write articles because to explain some of the idea of the books, and I do technical papers and books.
Right.
And everything else I do is because the publisher wants me to write op-eds. The rest I don't.
So, well then, let me put it a little bit differently. What are you hoping that your ideas, how do they add to the public understanding of you know, of how a good society would work better and what kinds of mistakes
to avoid? Well, it has already led to beautiful results. I mean, it was David Cameron when I was contacted by him and his administration to go before to help, you know, and I told him, listen, I'm not a public intellectual. But we can talk about my ideas through my books. I'm not going to write articles, and we can have a conversation. All right? It led to being demonized by sections of the British public. Who cares? And as well as here, but it had an effect. But I say I'm a lot. It's not bad. People can pick up these ideas very quickly. My point is to have a systematic approach to making decisions under incomplete information and under incomplete understanding of things.
Right.
And build a society that doesn't blow up if someone makes a mistake, which is the same thing. Right. Now, the society seems to have unique attributes, and I'm not the first person to think of these matters. It's just I've devoted my life to the furthering of the cause, intellectually.
Talk about that in terms of, you know, mistakes that then, you know, blow up, and you talk about iatrogenic effects of interventions into the economy or into the social system. Because we've had this. We've had a bunch of blow-ups, and then typically what happens is that we need a bigger government. You know, if government is partly to blame or partly responsible for something, then we need a bigger government response in order to fix it. And you talk about that.
Exactly.
How do we break that cycle?
Well, via negativa. Via negativa is if I want to cure diabetes and I give you any drug, all right, and people typically take drugs, then they have to take more drugs, and side effects multiply, and they spend their lives making pharma richer. So you have unintended multiple, you know, chains, unintended consequences, branching out. All right. If you remove, say, sugar from the person or food, and make someone starve for 600 calories a day for 6 weeks, you can gain your weight back, and you remove diabetes with the same probability as having good drugs.
Right.
All right. But there are no side effects. It's called via negativa, from Orthodox theology. Via negativa is you can't figure out what God is, but I can safely say what He's not. All right. So, the via negativa permeates this book as a robust decision making stuff like that. So, what we should remove. So, removing is like removing some sections of government is probably the best thing we could achieve. But since Reagan, you know, I haven't seen it done.
But he's a problem, right? Because you were just saying, I mean. His rhetoric was, I'm getting rid of government, but in fact, he was bailing out banks.
He bailed out Continental. He nationalized the bank.
Yeah.
Nationalized the bank, Continental Illinois. And then later on, these people blew up in the crash of 87 from bad risk management. Just to tell you, I mean, it was not a. But Thatcher came removal, all right? Removal of something harmful, doesn't have long term side effects.
Right.
Okay, as a first step, and then you can see what we became addicted to addition. And academics like to add, and they like to complexify. And practitioners, we like simple and we like subtractive things.
Who were your intellectual heroes? I mean, when I read your work and I looked at the, you know, at the index of various books, and I mean, I'll see a couple of references to Hayek or Karl Popper. Joseph Schumpeter is in the index for anti-fragility, but you say these are not, I mean, economists are not the people who have generated your ideas. you know, where did they come from and how much of it is personal? I mean, you grew up
in Lebanon,
you've
had cancer. A lot of it is personal.
Yeah, so.
A lot of it is personal, but I would say two things. The first one is that Schumpeter is creative destruction. You cannot, an economist cannot come up with an idea as brilliant as that. So it had to be someone before him. It turned out to be Karl Marx.
Right. Well, recycling, which he was open about.
Recycling Nietzsche. Mm-hmm. And Nietzsche understands the Dionysian and the Apollonian, that you have the reason, Dionysian, and those dark forces. Mm-hmm. And in here, Fat Tony, my principal character from New Jersey, who's anti-intellectual, Fat Tony, takes Socrates to the cleaner by vindicating Nietzsche is what you don't understand isn't necessarily stupid.
Right.
You get the idea. Mm-hmm. What you don't see is not there. What is not intelligible, Nietzsche said, is not necessarily unintelligent, right? Which is the government, they do intelligent things and they can't abide by these forces. So that was Nietzsche, I would say, is more than anything. But Karl Popper, no, because Karl Popper isn't Karl Popper. I mean, the idea of the Black Swan dates from the Romans, and it was elaborated, of course, by someone called Victor Bouchard. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of people who wrote on absence of, evidence versus evidence of absence in the French literature before him. Mm-hmm. And actually, Nietzsche picked it up from Bouchard's book on Greek skeptics. And of course, you go Sextus Empiricus, their lineage. And of course, Al-Ghazali, the Arab philosopher. Mm-hmm. The Arabic language philosopher Al-Ghazali, all these people have developed this notion of negative information is more important than positive information. So I wouldn't say Popper, it's just that people assimilated with Popper. I said, he thought of that, but then when I went into history, I realized that there were vastly more intelligent, deeper thinkers about the problem. The only thing Popper did that nobody else did is this argument about the future being unpredictable, because you have to forecast technologies that are unforecastable. That is a Popper. Yeah. Not the Popper of that people talk about.
Now, when you think about the future, are you optimistic or pessimistic, or is that the wrong way to approach
it? Well, I mean, it's the wrong way to view it. It's the wrong way to view it. My view of the future is not, they don't have to be right. Mm-hmm. So you have to have a dominant strategy to act as if you're pessimistic.
Right.
Like when I say that I don't want the pilot of the plane to be optimistic, you see, but I want the flight attendants to be extremely optimistic, you see. So so it's functional. Like, I don't believe in beliefs.
Yeah, well, and you talk about how pilots who are too comfortable with their knowledge and everything, they're bad pilots. They're the ones who have the errors.
Exactly, yeah. You have to have paranoid pilots and stressed all the time. So technology FFA figured out it makes flights less safe. But I take a stance, again, against knowledge. Knowledge isn't what runs society. Mm-hmm. Knowledge is largely a narrative that comes after we do facts. There's so much we narrate, and so much we do without a complete theory of things, you see. This is my central idea.
Well, to talk a bit more about capitalism in that, or a kind of system where it isn't knowledge per se, but you've talked about that. A lot of people talk about it as what's great about capitalism, it creates incentives that lead to success. When actually, capitalism, in your view, is about decentralization, about creating disincentives and failing early.
It's the exact opposite of incentive. It's disincentives.
Right.
Is have people have since Hammurabi, we've had civilized society, people living together, only able to do that when people are accountable for their mistakes.
Where are the kind of signal incidents of decentralization that's leading to better outcomes? Broadly speaking,
do you see that
either in the United States or in the West or in particular pockets and subcultures?
I mean, you have, take Switzerland as a culture where nobody can name the president easily, but they can name president of France. This is a good society because you have a lot of volatility, but, at the local lower level, micro level, translating to no volatility at the macro level, stability. So this Switzerland is a well-decentralized system.
Now, have you seen The Third Man, the Carol Reed
movie? Yeah, of course.
Orson Welles characters, Harry Lime, says, look, the Swiss have been around for hundreds of years and they've produced the cuckoo clock. Is that a cheap shot?
Or I think it's a very cheap shot. But there are other things I've discovered myself through time by looking through the surface. We typically attribute an over-centralized country actually to the rebirth of nation-state. Nation-state was born in Egypt and failed. born in China and failed, mm-hmm. and then born in France, okay, because mm-hmm. The Romans were too smart to have nation states. What Roman had was city states,
mm-hmm.
okay, and a system of city states.
Although within a larger context of an empire.
Yeah, it was a Pax Romana, what I call the barbell. Right. You see, no war, but, and then commerce, and then go live. And that was how, you know, my ancestry grew up, city states. So the French effectively, what they did is they had probably the weakest monarchy, mm-hmm. as you can see from the multiplication of languages mm-hmm. in a country, non-integrated area, mm-hmm. where the central government had no access, and you had more people speaking French in St. Petersburg mm-hmm. than you did in the provinces of France, okay, except along the tax lines. So France was only integrated after Napoleon. And it took a while till national education system, stuff like that, and the train system to integrate France. So France, and look, we have 400 cheeses, you mm-hmm. know. So France was, in effect, a diverse country mm-hmm. Till, I would say, well into the 20th century, mm-hmm. when after the first war they started.
And now, you know, it's common in the U.S. to just mock France, or France is everything that we're not, but France is also an economic powerhouse that has, 70 million people, but is, you know, one of the richest countries on the planet. So, but, I mean, they're doing, 55 million, that makes it even stronger. So,
but
there is power from that kind of centralization.
Okay, I mean, I don't quite believe, I mean, if you look at the strengths of France, mm-hmm. the centralization came to France mostly after De Gaulle's policies,
mm-hmm.
Later after the war, mm-hmm. as, you know, of course. It has not been, you cannot attribute the success of France to centralization.
Okay.
You see, that France was already a powerful and rich country mm-hmm. without too much centralization, or mm-hmm. without centralization. But without being hung up on France, the idea of deriving a rule from centralization, the problem is size. You know, mm-hmm. visibly you can have centralized government mm-hmm. in a small village. The problem is size. The problem is, as size gets larger, okay, you have some gains of economies of scale, whatever it is, but you have some losses mm-hmm. in governance and a lot of other things.
And this is, the more homogenous you become, the easier it is to be wiped out.
To be wiped out, to make big mistakes and be wiped out. This is the island effect at work, mm-hmm. you see. So, and you don't want, and what we have had in this country is a rise of the central government, mm-hmm. progressive rise of the central mm-hmm. government. And, you know, particularly the deficits are the works of central government. Mm-hmm. And as Hume figured out, he said small states and city states, they love commerce, mm-hmm. and large governments love war. Okay, and that's what justifies a large government, if a war. So they immediately looked like Germany after mm-hmm. they
after
got together, they got war. And you can see it, and there's no justification for large government mm-hmm. other than war, and they're not good at it.
Now, you say that you're not a libertarian, but a lot of this overlaps with what's considered. So why aren't you a libertarian?
Well, I mean, I don't know what libertarian is. Libertarian. I mean, I like I'm a risk-based person, mm-hmm. and I want, my libertarianism would be not deontic libertarianism, like, mm-hmm. the philosophical libertarianism that's, you know, freedom comes as a first good.
Right.
So much as I want errors to be multiplied. Mm-hmm. That's it.
Right.
You know, I want mm-hmm. errors to be multiplied, and I want.
So it's a kind of John Stuart Mill. You like the idea of experiments in living.
Exactly. Errors need to be multiplied. That's it. Is that so? I'm more of a in that sense. I'm not conservative 100%, but mm-hmm. I'm more of a left-wing conservative, if you mm-hmm. want. You see,
that's what Ayn Rand called libertarians, right-wing hippies. So.
There you go. So left-wing conservatives, that would map exactly. So it would be, I'm in a way, you know, I'm conservationist. Uh-huh. You know, I want to not break things that have been around for a long mm-hmm. time. They have their own logic.
Right.
And but I'm not against, you know, things, provided it comes from tinkering, mm-hmm. not from some radical transformation of things. And the most successful states in history have been city-states, mm-hmm. okay, or small. And even if we've had a lot of small wars, they produced great things. And, of course, sometimes you have an empire that prevents them at its own cost from waging wars. So mm-hmm. even better, you see, like Pax Romana. Or Pax Ottomana.
Let's, you know, we'll close out here by you've mentioned the barbell effect, or, you know, a kind of barbell-shaped distribution several times where you have certain things at the end, but not so much in the middle.
Yes.
You also write a lot in Anti-Fragility about barbells in terms of lifting. You at one point said that you could deadlift 330 pounds.
I didn't say I could deadlift. Oh, I say okay. If I deadlift 330 pounds. No, visibly I deadlift more.
Because we happen to have more. A stack of weights out here that we were going to...
That's very good. So we can try.
But... Talk a little bit about, because I mean, this is one of the things that I find both really...
I didn't say I was comparing. Okay. I was no. What happened is that the beauty of this book, the critics are incapable of addressing a central point. Yeah. So they nitpick and they nitpick on the wrong thing. They lift more than 330 pounds. Another interesting thing about this book, let me tell you one thing before we get there. It's written in a way to be loved by the reader and hated by the journalist. Why? Because you can't get into it. You can't figure out. You can't skim it.
If it means anything, one of the things that I'm an admirer of your work in the book, but I was like, I get the pose and I want to get to the information, which is another way of saying what you said, that it is. It's true. It's an experience. It's not. It isn't something that you can kind of strip mine for the meaning. It's very discursive.
And you go deeper in the topic. Don't leave anything. So someone who wants their ideas in every page, I don't leave
anything. And in that way, it's kind of curious that you are so popular in the business market, because most business books will end with like bullet points at the end of what this chapter was about.
I sort of have that, but we'll get. Yeah. But let me tell you what this book is. I learned from experience. I don't believe. Okay, so I enjoy writing. All right. The minute I'm bored writing, I stop. All right. So, and I developed some experience with it, particularly with the Black Swan, that to make sure that no content of any section can be discovered without surprising the reader somewhere. Mm-hmm. Okay. So you have titles and subtitles that don't really match.
Right.
So they're not bored. Textbooks bore you. Right. So, and I realized, that critics would hate it because they want skim books, but people who read will not hate it. A critic needs to get to the whole idea. And it happened to me with the Black Swan, that the people were frustrated. And I'm an empiricist. If you sell 3 million copies of a book writing in some way, I expect that the style isn't... I'm not going to be lectured about style. Mm-hmm. So, and then, of course, sure, the critics come in and they tell you it's a mess. No, you didn't see the order from the table of content, all right? Voluntarily. So you realize you're playing games with them, particularly they lecture you how to write when they've sold, the Black Swan sold more probably in a day than they sold in their lifetime. So you get the idea of being lectured.
You're not going to say that the market is always right and that 50 million Elvis fans can't be wrong.
No, but my point is that someone who is on his yacht, in the limo, doesn't take lectures on finance from someone who just rode the subway.
Right.
All right. That's the idea, that you can take ideas maybe if you want, but you don't, take instructions of how to write a book.
Right.
So if you want to write a book, you can take either instructions from the Harry Potter lady.
Right.
That's it. All right. So, or you can take instructions from Seneca, who survived 2,000 years, but definitely not from some academic at Cambridge who sold 2,200 copies. You get the idea. So this is what I have to say about being lectured. But yet these are the ones who write book reviews.
Right.
So you have to bypass the saying, and it's only a difficult phase in the beginning. Well, you get out of the way, and then as with the Black Swan, then you have an open 5 years for people to discover your book without them, and that's what happens.
So to just end with barbells,
yes.
Your preferred workout plan then is talk about your, the Nassim Taleb.
Let me tell you why.
Plan.
First, why do I talk about myself?
That's...
Because as I say here, skin in the game, I'm not allowed to give you advice.
Mm-hmm.
I don't tell you what you should buy. I tell you what's in my portfolio. People are shocked I'm talking about my portfolio. Yeah, because it's unfair. I'd be a Stiglitz telling you what you should be doing. Without being harmed if I'm wrong.
Right.
It's unethical for me, for my own system of ethics, okay? So therefore, I can't tell you. I can tell you what I do. So what I do now, I came with 21 days of eating without exercise, but what I do is I try to lift weight and imitating, and then I try to not take, instructions, but try to find big doorman at the gym who lift weight and see what their routine is and imitate it without having a trainer. Observe what they do, not what they tell you, all right? Because if you ask them, they give you a different story. So that's sort of like my idea. So I take walks, long walks, 20, 30 hours a week of walking. And that's one thing that, happened later on to discover that Nietzsche said, never trust ideas you haven't had walking, right? Mm-hmm. So I walk a lot, and I lift a very heavy weight, and that's it.
Can I just, is Nietzsche the best life guide? Especially, he told one story, which is very interesting. If you imitated him, you wouldn't be here right now, would you?
Well, Nietzsche was sickly from the beginning. Mm-hmm. So, for his days, he did very well, for sickly from the beginning. But Nietzsche was not,
do what he says, not what he does.
No, I mean, in what sense? Nietzsche is not about the sort of Übermensch, but he didn't take a lot of personal risks in his life. Mm-hmm. That's true. I try to take more personal risks.
Right.
I think my guide isn't Nietzsche so much as the people uncovered by Nietzsche. My guides are the classics. Yeah. The respect I have for the elders is so high compared to Nietzsche because they've been around longer. Yeah. But if you look at how the elders were, the only thing they respected is courage. And of course, actions, not words and stuff like that. And also skin in the game as a rank. So and now I'm taking risk, not with whatever, trying to take risk with this. I know that I'm going against the establishment, saying things the way they are. Lawsuits are probably gonna come, so what? The more risk I take for my ideas, the happier.
The better I do.
The
better I do.
Why?
Because if you fail, then I learn from your mistakes.
That's true. And also, probably if you have a cause, and we have similar cause for a lot of things, it would probably help. But I have the only thing that makes me feel that I am, my idea of living is taking risks for causes. So the more risks I take now of being attacked by academia, by someone putting some note on my dinner table, in a restaurant, the more I do, the more I feel good about myself.
Right. Well, take risk. Thank you. Thank you very much. I want to. I think we'll end it there.
Thank you,
Nassim Nicholas Taleb, author most recently of Anti-Fragility. Thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you very much.
Very much.
Thanks.